players here. Frankly, I would not have come to hear me speak in this weather. It never ever gets this cold anywhere in Australia ever. we are here in the Northern Hemisphere to be expected. Okay. So first of all, just a very, very brief intro to something that you probably already are familiar with, which is the Rambam's life. Just very, very briefly, we're talking about born on 1135, passed away about 1204. The Rambam was born in Cordoba, Spain, and grew up there until around age 16, when, as you probably know, the Almohad Muslims invaded Spain. Spain had been under the Muslims, but under the original Muslims who took over Spain in 711, it was not bad for the Jews. The Jews had granted, we had religious protection as a minority called Dima, or Dimi in Arabic, and we paid jizya, which is a tribute tax to the Muslims, but on the whole, freedom of religion, and Jews and Christians, known as Al-Kitab, the people of the book, had the ability to keep their religion. And there was almost what they call in Spanish, there was a what they call convivencia, which means the living together. Jews, Christians, it was working out. Until the invasion of the Almohads. So the Almohads, which is related to the Arabic Al-Mahadim, those who declare the oneness of God, were Arab or Muslims who believed that the Jews and Christians were indeed not protected by Dima, and the Jews and Christians were not really monotheistic, and hence they made it impossible to keep Judaism in Spain. You either had to convert, die, or leave. So the Rambam's family, his father was a Dayan, a judge, Maimon, and they left and they wandered in Spain for a while, eventually went to Morocco, and Morocco was also had problems there with the Muslims as well, and eventually went to the land of Israel in a letter which we're not absolutely certain is authentic, but very possible. What does that mean? Something's possible. Could be authentic, but we don't know for sure it's authentic. But there's a very interesting letter. You don't have it on the outline here, which the Rambam describes how he was in the boat from Morocco on the way to Israel, and there was a terrible storm, and they felt the boat was going to sink. He went down into his room and he stayed there alone, just him and God, he said. And he said, and they were saved from the storm, and that day he declared and dedicated to be a day that he will be alone with Hashem on that day, and in prayer and fasting and meditation. They eventually got to the land of Israel. They landed in the port of Akko. And in that letter, the Rambam writes, he declared that day a day of feasting, a Su'uda, a Yom Tov, to celebrate the first day he set foot in Eretz HaKodesh, in the land of Israel, the Holy Land of Israel. And then from Akko they went to Yerushalayim, and he made another Yom Tov on the day that he was first able to daven, to pray at the Kotel, the Western Wall. And they eventually made their way to Hebron, to the Maras HaMachpelah, and he made another Yom Tov in the family on the day he was merited to pray at the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs in Hebron. So Yitzhak Shilat, who has a translation of the letters of the Rambam, classifies that letter as not clear that it is authentically from the Rambam. But it is interesting anyway. So he eventually goes to Israel, and from Israel was not able to stay in Israel, and due probably to Crusaders. But anyway, he went to Cairo and moved to Cairo. Cairo at the time was one of the centres of the Jewish world, certainly the centre of the Mediterranean Jewish world. It was a place where there were people from all over the Jewish world would travel there. We have Baruch Hashem, due to the discovery of the Cairo Geniza in a shul in Fostat, which is old Cairo, the 19th century, various people responsible for it, but primarily Solomon Schechter, and the uncovering of thousands and thousands, to be more precise, over 300,000 documents in the Cairo Geniza, included amongst them ksuvas, prenuptial agreements, business letters, receipts, checks, a hechsher, letters of the Rambam's writings in his own handwriting, some of them Pirush HaMishnayos, commentary on the Mishnah, letters, responsa, shiur notes from his students, letters of Rav Yudah HaLevi, a poem of the wife of Dunash ibn Lebret, who composed Dror Yikra, and an amazing treasure house of knowledge that was uncovered there, which initially was considered a treasure because of the scholarship of the documents from the Rambam and Rav Yudah HaLevi and great scholars, and later on, primarily thanks to the work of Sholem Dov Goitien in Princeton, was realized to be also a treasure house in terms of the checks and the sales receipts and the school reports, because it revealed its huge amount about the lives of Jews in that Mediterranean society going back 1,000 years. So fascinating, fascinating stuff, and a fair amount of it from the Rambam. So he moved to Cairo. Again, this central, by the way, one of the oldest Yiddish letters is also in the Cairo Geniza, from a woman called Rochel to her son in Cairo. Part of it is telling him off for not corresponding more. So it's how typical can you get, really, right? So and we have there some letters of the Rambam and others. There's one letter of the Rambam there. Again, it's not in the outline here, but one of the letters of the Rambam there is a letter to Yitzhak Al-Dari, who was apparently a relative of his, who was going to a place called Munat Zift, I think it was called, something like that, and he wanted a letter of recommendation from the Rambam to attest to the fact that he was a Talmud Chacham, a scholar. And the Rambam wrote that, because evidently this guy was a scholar. I think it had ramifications, because sometimes financial ramifications, because communities would often pay the jizya, the poll tax that had to be paid to the Muslims, community would pay it to Torah scholars. So having a letter from the Rambam that you're a Torah scholar was probably handy in terms of that. So we have a letter from him, and it's signed. It's written, as most letters of the Rambam, and as most of the stuff in the Cairo Geniza, was written in what's called Judeo-Arabic, which is much like Yiddish, is German with some Hebrew chucked in, and Aramaic, and written in Hebrew letters. So Judeo-Arabic is Arabic with some Hebrew thrown in, written in Hebrew letters. And that was the standard of what the Jews wrote in the time of the Rambam, was Judeo-Arabic. We'll see there are a few exceptions in his letters, but most of the letters are written in Judeo-Arabic, as was his Pirush HaMishnayos, commentary on the Mishnah, Moreh HaNevuchim, also in Judeo-Arabic. One of the most beautiful things I saw, it's in Cambridge University, in the Taylor Schechter Geniza Research Unit. I've seen actually letters of the Rambam in his handwriting. They have them there. I saw a manuscript of the Moreh HaNevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed, in Judeo-Arabic, and what's nice, there's a squiggle on it, a very artistic type of squiggle. I asked the curator there, Ben Outhwaite, what it is. He said the Rambam's, if you look at the writing, you'll see the Rambam's pen was running out of ink. And he got here, he must have re-dipped it and did a squiggle to get it running, and then you look at the letters afterwards, they're much bolder. So, you know, I don't know why that attracted me so much. I guess that the humanity of the Rambam, right? His pen ran out of ink, right? And he had to redip it, right? It wasn't like he wasn't sitting in some stratosphere without any physical issues. And that's like, he was a real human being who did superhuman stuff. And so that was a very beautiful thing to see. And also there in the same manuscript, you see his abbreviation for the name of Hashem is like a three yuds, a yud, a little chick chick type of abbreviation mark, another yud, as is common to use today. You look in Sidurim, a lot of them have yud, quotation mark yud, as an abbreviation for Hashem's name. And at least my Rebbe Rabbi Shapiro said that he feels that probably it's the use of the first letter of the way Hashem's name is written and the last letter of the way it is pronounced. So the way it is written is Yud Kei and Vav Kei. The way it's pronounced is Aleph Dalad Nun Yud. So the first letter of the way it's written and the last letter of the way it's pronounced, Yud Yud. That forms the abbreviation of Hashem's name, and you see it going far back as the Rambam in his letters there. There are also letters there, not only by the Rambam, but also about the Rambam. There's a letter there of a man who came with his young son to bring, he was a shliach, an agent of a Beis Din, to bring a letter to the Rambam to ask for his opinion on some halachic issue. And he came, and the Rambam's son, Avraham, took care of his son, and they played together, and the Rambam was very gracious, and he writes how the Rambam brought out lemon cake, which he liked a lot, so we know the Rambam liked lemon cake, right, and his pen ran out of ink. So two important things. And also there in the Gemizah you have, aside from letters, we also have autograph edition of the Mishneh Torah, where you can see things that the Rambam crossed out and rewrote. Just one thing that I remember is there's a section which we in Mishneh Torah, which was written in Hebrew, is called Hilchot Nizkei Mamon. So originally the Rambam, you look there, it says Hilchot Nizikin, laws of damages. Nizikin is crossed out by the Rambam, and he's rewritten Nizkei Mamon, damaged by property, because that's a more precise title for the section. So when you study Mishneh Torah, as we probably all have in yeshiva at some point, right, we take great care looking at it. We look at the deductions from the title and the topics and the order, and that is justified when you look at the care the Rambam put into it. Right, he's and that manuscript's still in the Cambridge University Library. So anyway, those are some of our sources for the letters of the Rambam, and they were published in a few different editions. The old Shuvas HaRambam, the Igroisav edition, and again translated, a lot of them translated into, all of them translated here into Hebrew, although as I said, some of them were written in Hebrew, but the vast majority are written in Judeo-Arabic. And you have also, there's a modern edition, a critical edition, Yitzhak Shilat, a new translation from the Arabic into the English. There's a Mossad Rav Kook edition, which has a few, Yosef Kafir translated, a Yemenite scholar, did a lot of translation of the Rambam from Arabic into modern Hebrew. Okay, so that's a little bit of an intro. What do his letters cover? A vast range of topics. Just to give you an idea of the just a range of topics that his letters cover. Looking through an index, laws of Shema, laws of Tefillah, prayer, Tefillah, Mezuzah, Sefer Torah, Tzitzit, Brachot, Brit Milah, conversion, Shabbat, Yom Tov, Kiddush HaChodesh, fast days, Chanukah, Megillah, marriage, divorce, Yibum, Chalitza, prohibited relationships, prohibited food, laws of Shechita, vows, excommunication, Truma, tithes, mixes, sabbatical year, acquisition, gifts, renting, laws of neighbors, messages, partners, borrowing, deposits, lending, borrowing, litigation, interest, testimony, and comments on Talmudic statements. Some of them are clarification of stuff he wrote. It's not in your outline yet. We'll get to the outline eventually, right? Stuff that he wrote in the Mishneh Torah. Sometimes people have questions. I'll give you one example. There's a famous kasha, apparently a stira, where the Rambam says in the laws of Tshuva that nothing stands in the way of Teshuva. Nothing. Hashem accepts tshuva no matter what. And then, but in the laws of Avodah Zorah, the Rambam writes that a person who was an apostate and became an Oved Avodah Zorah, became an idol worshipper, etc., we don't accept him back into the community. We always suspect. Interesting. So there's been a lot of discussion in Achronim about that apparent contradiction. The Rambam himself answers it. Right? Some of the discussion took place without an awareness that the Rambam himself had given an answer on it, right? But some of them come up with the same answer the Rambam came up with, which is interesting. Those who came up with a different answer, it would be interesting. It's almost like that joke they say about people, these Rabbonim who are in Beis Medrash in the Shemayim, and they're discussing a Rambam, a Shvera Rambam, Kasher and the Rambam, and this Sephardic gentleman comes over and he offers a possible explanation, which is a very simple explanation. And they say, no, it's definitely more Lomdush than that. And they say, who are you anyway? He says, Moshe ben Maimon. And they say, what would a Sephardi know about learning Rambam? Right, so But anyway, the Rambam's answer is that there are, he says, well, in laws of tshuva, I spoke about Hashem accepting. God always accepts tshuva. He says, in the other case, I spoke about the community accepting someone who is deeply embedded in idolatry. He says, we as a community, we have to be suspicious. Because maybe it's a subterfuge to do missionary work or something like that. And who knows? So he says, it's not a contradiction. And if you look at the language, it's borne out by that. Not that the Rambam needs evidence for his own explanation of himself, but you'll see in the language it says that. So some of these letters are actually explanations of things that the Rambam himself wrote. And of course, some of the more famous letters, he's got the letter to Yemen, Igeres Tayman, and in which the Yemenite Jews had experienced a terrible situation of oppression by the Muslims, forced conversions, and so it was unusual, but it happened. And not only that, there was a false Messiah, a Jew proclaimed himself to be the Messiah, Mashiach. And how do you deal with this situation? The Rambam's beautiful letter, literally, in the words of some Yemenite scholars, saved the lives of Yemenite Jews. I mean, in terms of it, gave them tremendous strength, chizuk. It explained to them why these things are happening, explained to them about the jealousy of others for Judaism and the attempted imitation of Judaism. He offered them some refutations of Islamic claims and how to deal with them. He offered them how to deal with the Mashiach, the false Messiah, which he showed is obviously not the Messiah. The fact that he says, A, the Messiah is meant to appear in Israel first. So Yemen ain't qualifying. So therefore he's A, clearly not the Mashiach. That's a detail, by the way, which is not in the Mishnah Torah, in the laws of Mashiach, but it is in the letter to Yemen. He also offers that this man is obviously insane, and he's obviously going to cause huge problems to the Jewish community. If you're able to have him locked up, committed, then you should do so. And he goes on to say, if you're not able to have him locked up and he's still a danger to the community, have him killed. So the Rambam in his Igeret Tamar, and in fact, he became so adored and famed by the Jews of Yemen that they included him in Kaddish. In fact, the Ramban mentions this in his defense, one of his letters defending the Rambam during the great controversies in Provence about the Moreh Nevuchim. The Ramban, in his defense of the Rambam, of his reputation, how great he was, he testifies that the Jews of Yemen, to this day, he said, in Kaddish, they say, V'chayechon uv'yomechon, in your lives and in your days, uv'chaye marana Moshe, and in the life of our master Moshe. And they go on. By the way, that particular type of nusach, including the names of rabbis, in the Cairo Geniza, there's a Kaddish from Israel, which predates the Rambam, in which they included the names of Rosh Yeshiva in the Kaddish. The Chayechon of Yomechon of Chaye, I think it says, Gaon, Rosh Yeshiva, Gaon Yaakov, and it says the pet man's name, Rosh HaChabura, and there's three Rabbonim with all their titles in Kaddish. I mean, Kaddish could get really long if you live in a place with a big yeshiva, right? In Lakewood, you'd never finish Kaddish, right? But they did include the Rambam in their Kaddish, and very, very beautifully, because he saved their lives. He has other letters, Kiddush Hashem, the letter about Kiddush Hashem, and his criticism of rabbis who felt that you had to die rather than claim you're accepting Islam. He said all you have to do is say a sentence, you know, Allah is God and Muhammad is his. He says in his language, shmad na'ehizu, right? It's a pleasant shmad. It's like it's not a difficult type of oppression. You know, just say the sentence and you'll be done with it. It's not idolatry. And he felt that rabbis who told people to die rather than do that had blood on their hands. And he also writes about accepting Jews back into the community, even though they had once converted. And very, very beautifully, he says, once you're a Jew, you're always a Jew. And he says, even Yerovam ben Nevat shchikat somas, Yerovam ben Nevat, may his bones be ground up. He says, even he is obligated to sit in the sukkah on Sukkot and to say a bracha. Right? You're always a Jew. Zera Avraham enokala, the seed of Abraham is never over. Right, once a Jew, always a Jew. And then there's some letters to various people. One of the famous letters is to Yehuda Ibn Tibbon, who translated a lot of the Rambam's works. He lived in Provence in southern France. He wanted to travel to Cairo to see the Rambam, to meet the Rambam. And there, in a beautiful letter, the Rambam writes back, he says, look, I love you like my own son. And he says, and you're a great translator. He says, but to travel all the way here, he says, let me tell you what my day is like. I get up at dawn and I pray. I then take a long journey on donkey from Fostat to the court of Salah al-Dem, the Saladin, who was his patient, or at least his viceroy was a patient, and the harem and the whole court. He says, I go and treat them all day. I come home in the afternoon, late afternoon, I get home, it's already evening. I eat, I pray, and by the time I get home, there's already a line of people waiting outside the surgery for me, Jews and non-Jews alike, all waiting to see me, because he was a physician. And he says that, I then, look through, greet all these patients and examine them. He says, by late into the night, I'm too tired to stand, so I lie on the bed and the patients have to stand. So I'm lying on the couch, he says, I'm examining the patients, I'm too tired to stand up. He says, on Shabbat, he says, people come from all over to ask me questions. I spend most of the day answering people's questions. I learn a little bit if I can. He says, so I could squeeze you in 5 minutes. You're going to schlep all the way from Provence to Cairo, across the Mediterranean, in order to see me for 5 minutes. Not worth it. Right? So that's a very famous and beautiful letter to Ibn Tibbon, and various other letters. So let's have a look actually at some of the letters. So the first one on your outline, which is, as you imagine, on page one, is a tshuva. Yeah, I'm not going to go through this word for word. We're never going to finish. So, but basically, the tshuva is about a fellow in a shul somewhere who wanted to decorate his talus, and he wanted to decorate it by embroidering in the writing of the Torah scroll, Ksav Ashuris, embroidering a pasuk on his talus. I'm not sure where on the talus, doesn't actually say, but he wanted to embroidered a sentence on the talus. The rabbi angrily told the fellow that he shouldn't do so. And he wants to know from the Rambam, is he right? Is this congregant correct? Is the rabbi right? Who's right? So the Rambam says, he says, first of all, your congregant is wrong. For a few reasons. He says, you're not supposed to write psukim of the Torah in general. Maybe if you're writing Divrei Torah, fine, but if you're just writing it for decorative purposes or something like that, you should not write more than three letters. To write an entire pasuk is not right. And he says, if you need to bring a proof from a pasuk or something like that, so we generally try to write it, b'chulhu, maybe one or two words, and then etc., so as to avoid exposing the verses of the Torah to being thrown out, recycled, or whatever you do. He says, in addition, he says, a second reason, he says, is that, and this is even stronger than the other, he says, tzitzit, the talit, is tashmishay mitzvah, meaning it's used for a mitzvah, but it doesn't have the kedusha, like kedushas haguf, of something like tefillin. He says, so you technically could wear a talus with tzitzis into a bathroom. Okay, we wear tzitzis into the bathroom. He says, but a pasuk of the Torah you're not allowed to take into the bathroom. So putting a pasuk on something you're allowed to wear into the bathroom is risking taking a pasuk of the Torah into the bathroom, which is certainly inappropriate. So having a t-shirt with a pasuk on it, you're not allowed to do that, because you can wear a t-shirt into the bathroom, you can't wear a pasuk into the bathroom. He says putting on a talus is exactly the same reason, and hence is prohibited for that reason. He says another reason, nosaf, in addition, gam kein chidush ustia shalahaya kemoto b'Yisrael l'fiya deyateinu. It is also, he says, something new, which Jews never did, as far as I know. So in other words, a little bit conservative. In other words, right, why would you do something that Jews never did? Right? He says it's like unusual. So number one, he says, don't write psukim of the Torah. You just shouldn't do that unless you really need to. And even when you really need to, we only write them two or three words and then write etc. He says, secondly, you're exposing the words of Torah to the risk of someone wearing them into the bathroom, which is prohibited. And number three, he says, this is a new thing. Who knows why you do, this is not done by the Jews. And a fascinating, his fourth reason, which is actually quoted by the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Sefer Torah, his fourth reason is, he says, it's an ancient custom of the Jews not to use the writing, Ksav Ashuris, the writing of the Torah scroll, right, because the Torah was given in that writing, for anything except Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzah. He says, so to use Ksav Ashuris, this writing, for anything else is wrong. He says, it's an ancient custom. And he says, and he adds a little bit of an archaeological, little archaeological insight here. He says, if you have a look, it's the paragraph starting, V'lo Pasku Yisrael. V'lo Pasku Yisrael Me'u Shamer Bezeh. He says the Jews were very careful about this custom. And he says all their writings were in Ktav Ivri. That's what we call old Hebrew writing. If you look at old Shkalim, old coins, you find them not with Ktav Ashurit, the writing of the Torah scroll on them, but they're always written in what we call the Ktav Ivri Yashan, Old Hebrew. You don't find even one letter of this Ashurit script of the Torah scroll in any of the archaeological remnants of the Jews. Lo becharitat matbea, neither engraved on coins, v'lo becharitat even, neither engraved on walls, on stone, ela kol ze b'ktav Ivri. All of this in Ivri. And he says, that's why Hayu Asfardim Katvam Shinu Asfardim Katvam Nat Lo'atiyot Tzorot Achorot. That's why he says the Sfardim utilized, created different scripts for their regular weekday writing in order to avoid using the Ktav Ashurit. That's the origin of the, in Italy, the Jews of Italy used a particular type of script which we are all familiar with, and we call it Rashi script. We have no idea if Rashi ever used that script, probably not. But that script was used by the Italian, but the printers in Italy, Bomberg and the guy Cornelius Mandelkorn, who was the person who worked for him, they had the Talmud, the Gemara, in the square script, the Chumash in the square script, and the commentaries they put into a different script. Okay, and the first one, I think the first commentary printed in that script was Rashi, so hence Tav Rashi, so don't blame Rashi for that. But anyway, so he says that was why the Sfardim, the Spanish Jews, changed the writing so as not to avoid that. So it's interesting. He says a whole lot of reasons that is prohibited. A, don't write Psukim for just for decoration. They're for learning. They're holy. He says number two. He says you could carry this into the bathroom, and you shouldn't expose the pasuk to the risk of having it taken into the bathroom on a garment that you can indeed wear to the bathroom. Number three, he says, it's a new thing. He says, not something the Jews have done in past. Number four, he says, it's a custom, ancient custom, which you see from archaeology that the Jews actually observe from time immemorial, right, that we don't use this type of writing for anything but Torah, Tefillah, Mezuzah, and therefore you should not use it for anything else, only Divrei Kedusha. Obviously, bar mitzvah invitations would be a davar shebe kedusha. Right, so that was a joke. But anyway, and he says, then at the end he says the following. The last paragraph. He says, the second last paragraph. K'moshelo schar al kavanatoli mitzvah. As this person is going to get rewarded for his intention to decorate the mitzvah and to make it beautiful, Yelo schara yoter gadol, he'll have even greater reward. Yimichabei divrei Elohim, the yachtoch el rakamot, if he honors the words of God and cuts off that embroidery from his talus. Asher behem divrei Elohim chayim, the yiganzein, and he should put him into gniza, zot chayavim lasot. Now he says, very beautifully, he says, explain to this guy that yes, his intention is wonderful, and as he was getting rewarded for trying to beautify a mitzvah, he'll get even more reward for giving respect to the words of Torah. And then he says, "Im hamamuna mitama halacha mochiach mishenofel mimenu b'chochma al davar miinyanei ha'isur v'heter." And if someone appointed in halachic areas, like a rabbi, rebukes someone in an area of halacha, chayav hu lekabel zot mimenu v'lo lachlok, he should accept this from the rabbi. V'alyei bur, and not to be an ignoramus. Hashem in Shemanav, one of the signs of a boor or unrefined person, medaber lifnei shu gadol memena b'chochma, is someone who speaks in the presence of someone who's greater than him in wisdom. V'im lo yikabol memenu v'yatmid sh'alav hochicha, harehu bar nidui. If he continues to ignore the rebuke of the rabbi, he is fitting to be excommunicated. Lefishu Ovel Isur Vimze Mavaze Tamir Chamim, that he is, because he's A, transgressing a prohibition, and B, being disrespectful to a sage. Shubichlal is Bizayon Dvar Hashem. But then he adds, and this is important, V'ra'ui Gam Kein L'mumuneh, but that person who's appointed to rebuke people, Afilu Tia Madregato Gadola, even if he is very, very great, Linogi Matsibur Benachat, he should deal with the community Benachat, meaning gently, gently. The Yimchol Al Kvodo, and he should be foregoing regarding his honor. The Yimchel Kol Davar Shrein Lichot, yes, he should object to those things that require his objection, Benachat V'adinut, gently and pleasantly. Sheyechayev Sheyekablu Dvarav Baratzon, because then people will accept his words willingly. Ad sheyachzirim la'asiyat hanachon ba'botot ahava, so he can return them to do the right thing with cables of love. So the Rambam, I think it's, and he does this quite a few times in his letters, will say, you're right that you did it incorrectly. In other words, you're right. He says to the rabbi, you are correct. Halachically speaking, 100% correct, and this gentleman who did not accept it from you, he is wrong. He says, but I want to tell you something. You want words to be listened to, you want to rebuke someone, how should you do it? Gently. Right, not with a patch, but with nachat. And he says, actually, in the laws of Hilchos Deos, when he talks about the laws of Toichacha, the machia someone, rebuking someone, he says very clearly, rebuke has to be done with the nachat, gently, b'derech kavod, in a respectful fashion. And if you skip to another letter here, which is actually on the next, I think it's on the next page. Actually, it's not on the next page. It's actually on page 3. There are 3 letters which the Rambam wrote in Hebrew, not in Judeo-Arabic, and all 3 letters are to one person, Ovadia the Ger. There's a convert to Judaism, an Arab who converted to Judaism, Ovadia, his name was. There was another famous convert, 2 other famous converts. Well, of course, the original was Ovadia, who was the prophet Ovadia, who was a Ger from Edom, and hence a lot of Gerim called their names Ovadia. There was another famous convert who was Ovadia from Italy, Johann. He had been a monk who converted to Judaism from Christianity, obviously at great risk to his life, and made his way from Italy to Aleppo, from there to Cairo. And we actually have in the Gniza, there's actually a song by him, a piyut, called Mi'al Ha'Chorev, a song about Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's actually got the musical notes on it in his handwriting, which has been reconstructed by some Israeli musicians. So we actually have music, Jewish music, from 11th century Cairo, which is extremely cool. It's great music. It's beautiful. But they reconstructed the notes, because he wrote that. Anyway, that's a different Ovadia. This Ovadia was an Arab, Muslim, who converted to Judaism. And there are 3 letters he addresses, 3 questions he addresses to the Rambam, and the Rambam answers each 3. And here, the Rambam answers not in Judeo-Arabic, but specifically in Hebrew, even though he's speaking to a guy, Ovadia, who was a born-bred Arab, who Arabic was his native ethnic language. Why is he writing to him in Hebrew? Any ideas here? I think it's a little sensitivity. What's he saying? By writing to him in Hebrew, what's he saying? That's right, you're one of us, right? I'm writing to you in our language, not in Arabic. Yes, even though to everyone else he wrote in Arabic. But to the Arab, who's now Jewish, he writes in Hebrew. I think there's a little sensitivity there to illustrate to this person that you are Achenu Ata. Yeah.
How did Avadia write the Rambam? What language did he use?
We don't have his question. Oh. We only have the Rambam's answer, so I can't answer that. I don't know. So anyway, of one of the 3 questions, the last question, this is, I've got it, the 3rd question here, he asked the Rambam, he says that, he was in a synagogue, and his rabbi was giving a class, and the rabbi in his shul said, the rabbi, I say shul, right? And you know, because which is more familiar to me than synagogue, but obviously shul would not be familiar to the Rambam. But you know, so you understand. I'm not assuming that the Rambam spoke Yiddish, right, or anything like that, or despite the letter in the Gemiza, right? And also, as opposed to, let's say, the pictures they send home at cheders in Monsey and Passaic and Lakewood, where the Bris of Yitzchak, everyone's wearing strimals. Okay, not quite. But anyway, but I'm using shul just because I'm more familiar with that. But anyway, the Rav in this Ovadia shul, the Rav had expressed the opinion that Islam is idolatry. Tavodah Zorah. And Ovadia said, excuse me, Rabbi, but I was a Muslim, and my knowledge of Islam is that it's not idolatry, it's actually monotheistic. So the Rambam says in Mishnah Torah is so. And the Rambam responds, and anyway, apparently the rabbi got angry at Ovadia and called him a fool and yelled at him in public. So the Rambam writes back, he says, number one, you're right, the rabbi's wrong. He says, I've read the works of the Muslims and their commentaries, and there's no question in my mind that they are monotheists. He says, idolatry has been erased from them. He says, even if they have customs which date back to idolatrous times, he says, their intention, what's in their minds and in their mouths, is certainly devotion to one God, and there's no question that they are monotheists, so you're right, the rabbi's wrong. He says, number one, he says, and even if you were wrong and the rabbi's right, is he not aware of over 30 places in the Torah where it says do not oppress the convert? Your rabbi has transgressed a biblical prohibition by oppressing you and insulting you. And he says, and he did it in public, so he's humiliating you. Even if he was right and you were wrong, how much more so, since he is wrong and you are right, he should have rebuked you gently. He should not have called, and to call you a fool. If by his understanding you've come from idolatry to monotheism, how could you be called a fool? You are the most intelligent of people. You've come from what he considers idolatry to monotheism. You are the most intelligent of people. How could he say this? And then, in a great clincher, he says, and rather than the rabbi looking into Islam and discussing whether they're idolaters, he should look at himself and think about himself. Is he an idolater? Because the Talmud says in Shabbos that he who loses in temper should be in your eyes as though he has worshipped idols. He says, so not only are the Muslims not idol worshippers, but your rabbi might be. Signed Rambam. You know, not a letter that the rabbi would have put up in his office. Hey, look, I've got a letter from the Rambam. Right? So, but it's really, wow. You know, you look at a letter like that, he doesn't hold back any punches here. Fascinating. In another letter to Ovadia, because evidently he had a lot of arguments with this rabbi. Okay, so maybe the rabbi got a little frustrated, but okay. So another letter that Ovadia asks the Rambam is, what about in the brachot? I feel a little bit uncomfortable. Can I say Elokeinu ve'Elokei Avoseinu? My God and the God of my fathers. He says, it's not referring to my fathers. Oh, it says, right? Nodelecha Hashem again. Al shichalta lavoteinu eretz chen l'tshuva chava. How can I say in benching birkat hamazon to say that you inherited this land to our ancestors? How can I say that? I'm not. So the Rambam says, first of all, before he gets to the halachic source for this, but the Rambam says to him, he says very beautifully. He says, first of all, he says, you can say all the. Oh, it's on page two. Top of page two. He says, all the brachot and all the tefillot you may say like any other Jew. Whether you are praying in private, whether you are public, whether you are the chazan, whether you remember the community, say them all exactly as any Jew says it. Elokeinu v'elokei avoteinu, shichaltu lavoteinu, shelo asani got, all of them, every single one, you can say it. He says, you know why? He says the following. Ikar adavar, the paragraph starts. Ikar adavar sheAvraham Avinu limed kol ha'am. It was Avraham who taught all these people. V'yiskilam v'yivinam, he gave them the intellect and the perception. Data emet, of the knowledge of truth, the religion of truth. Yichudo shalakadosh baruch hu, etc. And he says, and Hashem says, Yidativ lemani yishetzave banav ve'beito acharav v'shamu derech Hashem. He says, that always, when Hashem speaks to Abraham, it talks about Banav, his children, Ubeito Acharav, and his house after him. He says, Kol Mishi Gayer, Al Soko, anyone who converts to the end of all generations, Hein Bnei Beito Hein, they are the members of the house of Abraham. And they can legitimately say, Avoteinu, because you are Bnei Beito Shel Abraham. And who? Hizir Otan Lamuta, in the same way that Abraham directly brought people back to monotheism at that time, directly, he says he brought you back to monotheism through his descendants. So there are Bonov, the genealogical descendants of Abraham, and there is Bnei Beito, the ideological descendants of Abraham. And you are Bnei Beito of Abraham. You are a child of Abraham. I should point out, and the Rambam certainly did not, this is not the Rambam, but just parenthetically, just an interesting idea, the Zohar actually says, when it says, Va'nefesh asher asu b'charan, that Abraham and Sarah brought with them the souls they'd made in Haran. So as you probably know, Rashi says those are the people that they brought to monotheism, right? But the Zohar says Abraham and Sarah lived as man and wife. They didn't have physical children. But when they had lived as man and wife, they produced nefashot, souls. And hanefesh asher asu b'charan are the souls that Abraham and Sarah created in Haran by living together as man and wife. And those souls later on became the souls of Gerim, converts. And he says, therefore, the Zohar says that a convert is literally a child of Avram and Sarah. Nefesh asher asu b'charan. Interesting, Rav Reuven Margolius has got a fascinating book called Shemot v'Kinuyim b'Talmud, Names and Nicknames in the Gemara. It's a whole book about names and nicknames in the Gemara. So he wrote over 40 books, so the fact that he has a book about that shouldn't surprise us. So Reuven Margolius writes that there were two rabbis in the Gemara who were so proud of their being descended from Gerim that they actually had it in their name. Ben Bagbag and Ben Hehe. Ben Bagbag is Ben Ger, Ben Gioret, an abbreviation, son of a convert, son of a convertess, whatever, son of a male or female convert. And Ben Hehe is the son of people who had Hayes added to their names. Who had a hay added to their name when they entered the bris with Hashem? Avram became Avraham, and Sarai's yud was replaced with a hay. So Ben Hehe is the son of Avraham and Sarah. How beautiful is that? Anyway, so the Rambam, of course, wouldn't have accepted that the Nefesh explanation, that's a Zohar, but the Rambam says that you are B'nai Beis Shel Avram, and he says, and therefore, you can say Elokeinu v'Elokei Aviseinu, She'Avram Avinu Hu Avicha, Avram is your father. And you can say Shin Chaltel Avoteinu and all those things. He says, that's fine, that's not a problem. All those miracles were done for us and also for you. And all of the covenant was done for us and also for you. And then he adds another idea. He says that every single Jew, first of all, he says, the Torah says numerous times, Torah achat, mishpat echad, yelachem, velager hagaritchem. Ha'ezrach v'ager. How often does the Torah say that? I didn't count it, but the Torah says often, Ezrach, which means a natural born Israelite, and the hager, and the convert. And the Torah says many, many times, Chuka achat, one law for you and for the convert. One law for you and for the convert. He says, therefore there is no distinction. By the way, those who are familiar with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Kuzari will know that he disagreed with this. Right? Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and in general, the Kabbalists had a different understanding than the Rambam here. The Mekubalim understood that the Jewish soul is intrinsically different from the non-Jewish soul. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi went as far as saying that a convert can never get to exactly the same level as a Jew, as a born Jew. Right? And there was a lot of discussion about that, both in academia and also in the Mefarshim on the Kuzari. How could he say such a thing, etc., to some point to a Gemara that says, Eina Nevua Shoira Elal Mishpachas Miyachosas Yisrael, prophecy can only rest on a family which has got genealogical purity of the Jewish people. Some disagree. But it's an interesting question. But the Rambam certainly did not feel that this was the situation. He said, you can be exactly the same as the Torah. So first of all, he says, because you are Bnei Beisot. Avram refers to, Hashem refers to children, and Bnei Beisot, you are Bnei Beis of Avraham, number one. Number two, he says, the Torah emphasizes Chuka Achas. One law for you, one law for the converts, all the same. Or I shouldn't say one law for you. I should say the same law for you and for the stranger, for the convert, no question. And then he says a third point, which is, very beautifully, he says, every Jew ultimately is descended from a convert. Because what happened at Har Sinai was a mass conversion of a group of descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Yaakov to Judaism, because Judaism wasn't there before. When we got the Torah, that's when Judaism started. And consequently, we were not technically Jewish before Mount Sinai. So at Har Sinai, we converted. And how do we know this? Also, the Gemara in Christmas, and the Rambam legislates this in the Mishnah Torah, that what? Where do we learn all the laws of conversion of Gerus? From Har Sinai. The Rambam says it so explicitly in the Mishnah Torah. He says, just as they immersed and had purity, so the convert has to immerse. Just as they had bris milah, so the convert, they brought korbanos, so the convert has, in order to enter into the bris, which they said nasa v'nishma, as does the convert, more or less. Right? So therefore, really, everyone's a convert. It's just the question is, earlier or later conversion. So my ancestors converted, well, actually, I know quite a few generations back, but probably at Har Sinai, right? Or possibly, I don't know, with the Khazars, who knows, right? Just from my rugged, you know, looks, right? But no need to laugh at that. Anyway, so he says, so you're also, we're all converts in that sense. And then he says a very beautiful line. He says, Ayehe yichuscha kala be'enecha. Don't let your genealogy be light in your eyes. Sha'ata anu mityachasim la'Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. We trace ourselves back to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Ve'ata mityachais l'misha omar v'haya ha'olam. You trace yourself back to He who spoke and created the world. What a beautiful line. Ayehei yichuscha kala ve'enecha. Don't let your yichus, your genealogy, be light in your eyes. Yes, we trace ourselves back to Avraham. You trace yourself back to God. Say all the prayers. Then he deals with the halachic sources, which I'm not going to get into, but it's a fascinating and very sensitive and beautifully written letter. Any convert who receives such a letter, it would be I can only imagine it would be incredibly inspiring. There's another letter to Avadya, but I'm going to skip it for the moment because we are running out of time. On the last page, page six, it's the second last. Actually, I see I've repeated it, so it's the last one as well. So feel free to look at either version. I did cut and paste twice. Okay, so here's a question where it's very interesting. He asks, what about this law? Someone asked him, what about learning Torah with a non-Jew? Can I learn Torah with a goy? Gemara says, goy she'asa b'Torah, chayev misa, non-Jew, who engages in Torah, liable for the death penalty. So first of all, the Rambam says, even if we had rule and the Sanhedrin, it doesn't mean an actual death penalty. It just means in the hands of heaven. In other words, God considers it a serious crime. But not that we would actually do that, even if we had a Sanhedrin. He says, however, and here he says something fascinating. He says, you can learn Torah with a Christian, but not with a Muslim. You can learn Tanakh with a Christian, but not with a Muslim. And that sounds very strange, especially since we know that the Rambam held that Islam is monotheistic, and Christianity, because of their belief in the Trinity and the Incarnation, is idolatrous. So he says, so why is he then saying that you can learn Tanakh with a Christian, not with a Muslim? And he says very simply and beautifully, elegant distinction. He says, because the Christians believe in the same text that we have. Christians accept the text of the Tanakh, pretty much 90% of the text of the Tanakh that we have. They just have the incorrect interpretation. He says, so if you can learn with them and show them the correct pshat, right, etc., then you've brought them closer to the truth. It's a good thing. He says, but the Muslims don't even have the correct text, because the Muslims say that what did we do with our text? There's a Muslim doctrine called tahrif. Tahrif means the Jews distorted, corrupted, and censored and edited the text. And so the text of the Tanakh that we Jews have today, the Muslims would say, is not the Torah that was given to Moshe. He says, so what are you learning with? What's the use? You learn with them, you say, and they'll say, oh, that's a very nice pshat you've said. Too bad you have the wrong text. But with a Christian, he says, you can actually learn with them and they can accept it. And it's very good. If you turn to page 5, top of page 5, I'm going a little quicker now. And this is a great one. I love this one. It's the question is, Bedavar kriyat mizmorim utfilot, top of page 5. Adding or reading extra songs like piyutim and liturgical poems and stuff that's added to the prayers. What do you say about this? So he says, Eilu atosfot, the kriyat mizmarim ot filot, kagon filot Rav Saadji v'zulato, these poems that are added, like the ones written by Saadja, midivrei darshanutu musa lisnei filat ha-chabad, that were done before the obligatory prayers, kol ze yafe ma'od. They're very beautiful. V'ratsui kedei la'orer kavana, and they are wonderful in order to arouse the person's kavana intention. And they already said that the Hasidim HaRishonim used to have an hour of preparation before davening. But then, he says on the fourth line there, third line, Aval zeratsu ili yachid, but that's for the individual, or the yachidim, or individuals, shiachlu zot bevateim, to do this in their homes. Aval bevatei knisiot, but to do it in the shul, ladati ta'ut, that's a mistake. Why? Mishun tebatei knisiot l'rabim, they are for the many, for the public. The lu haya sham ish echad zaken, if there's an elderly person there, or chalash, or a weak person, or nimol, or a person who had circumcision, then it's acher. And he came like daka mitzvah of tzibur haya nizok bazeh. He says, what if someone, for reasons beyond their control, they're elderly, they're impaired, they're sick, etc., they come late. Right, or their tefillah is made longer. He says, yeah, you want to say piyutim to arouse your intention? You would like to increase your kavana with meditation? Do it at home, by yourself. But to enter it into, and to have it as part of the tefillah, when you've got a whole group of people there, no. He says, what about the old? What about the elderly? What about the elderly, the weak, the sick? Take them into account. And look what he says, b'chol zeh nikra b'shem tzibur hachalash shebahem. When we look at a community, who do we have to look at? The weakest amongst them. Umishtadlim lahakel aleihem b'chol panim. We try to make things easier for them in every way. Ve'ein mosifin aleihem b'toreach avodat Hashem. Don't add to them extra effort in the service of God. Wow! Isn't that a great... In other words, you say, if you're responsible for a community, you know who you have to look at always? The weakest link. The weakest person amongst them, and you have to try to do things to make it so that they can have an experience which is not toreach, the avodat Hashem. Don't make it. So he says, I love these poems; they're wonderful, and he may agree with that. He says they're wonderful for yourself, for individuals outside the shul. To add it into the prayers, don't do it. You have to look at it. You have to look at the weakest. So that was just a brief, and similar to that, he's got this other one, which is actually I've got in the scan, as opposed to, for some reason, I couldn't find this particular one on Bar Ilan, in which someone asked him a similar question, but it's about, Ma din ba'amirat otat fila, ashtikin rebenu sajigon, the cup of tingles above the yam and tovim, the smachot, the gil. Etc. He says, there's a prayer that Rav Sajagon wrote, can we say it on Shabbat? Yodienu Adonenu Natre Rachmona Mayi Adim Bazeh. Etc. Do you have to stand up? Not stand up, etc. So let's skip down to the answer. He says, the Rambam first of all says, Lo Yomar Kaddish Klal, Eile B'mekomot HaYuduim, Ashebit Filot, Aracha Kriyat Eze Davar, Medivei Torah, Perush, Odrash, Pasuk Echad, O Yomar Kaddish. Am achar elu atfilot asher tiken agaon elu atchinot shel rachamim ein shichim mehem kaddish. V'nolahir ben einos. Don't add kaddishes. There's a story I read about two guys. There's a guy at Ben Gurion Airport in the shul in Ben Gurion, and of course he's waiting for a flight and they're davening. And after davening, there's two guys there. One says noch a kaddish, another kaddish. So he adds to heal him, and he says another kaddish, and he says. One more Kaddish, right? So this guy, he happened to have, I think it was Orach HaShulchan, and he showed him, the Orach HaShulchan writes, like the Rambam says, Ein lahar bois the Kaddishim. You shouldn't say too many Kaddishes. So he shows it to the guy, says, look, says, Ein lahar bois the Kaddishim. So the guy says, Shloimele, who am I Dvar Torah, say Kaddish Rabbonon. So, anyway, you cannot win, right? But then he says this, he says, Eilu atak, these bakoshes and tefillos, which they copied from the Geonim, lochazi li amiros, lo li yachid, v'lo li tzibur, lo b'shabbat, lo b'shabbat, you should not say them privately or with a community, either on Shabbat or Yom Tov. And here we'll see absolute evidence the Rambam was not a litvak. Why? He says, "Mitznei shachachomim kasher tiknu davar kedei lama b'shabbos lecholah ki yoytze shabbos himelizoik kruach roi lava rachma barubim hodal levad." He says they didn't allow you to actually pray for the sick. They only allowed you to say that Hashem will heal as a statement of fact. Lomanu brocha inside, and they cut out the middle blessings of Shmona Esra. You've got to be happy and joyful. To Hashem who gave rest to the Jewish people. He says, he says, look, these prayers are beautiful during the week. He says, but it should not be a day of crying. It should not be a day of crying out, of supplications. No. He says, Lo yoma behem eila dvarim hanautim v'amasamchim. Only say appropriate, joyful things on Shabbat. Lahazki nifla'otav. And to mention the wonders of God, asher osa'im avoteinu v'lanu, he did for us and for our forefathers. And he says, it's a very interesting thing. He's saying that, again, some of these piyutim are very beautiful, but he says, you should not be saying sad stuff on Shabbos. Right? I have a friend who always bemoans when we have a chazan. Sometimes he'll do a lecha dodi, which literally sounds like kinnis. I mean, it's like, you know, right? I mean, it's supposed to be happy. You don't have to be a kalabach minyan. But I mean, on the other hand, right? It should be in keeping with the meaning of the word, right? It's happy, joyful nigunim. I remember I did a Shabbaton in Los Angeles. A good friend of mine is a rabbi there. Is a Yemenite, Taimani. So the guy started singing. Some people started singing this very yeshivish tune for I forgot what the zmira was. Baruch Kel Elyon, really slow tune. And he says, I recognize that tune from Tayman. I said, really? He says, yeah, on Tisha B'Av we used to do it. Right? But anyway, right? Exactly. If you listen to the Sephardi, Spanish Portuguese minhag of the tunes they use on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And you compare it to us, it's very, very different. Very different.
Yeah, it's a different tonal scale.
Total. Well, but also, the emotion seems a little different. It's less of an emotion, as Professor Perilous put it. He says, it's less of an emotion that I'm a wretched, hopeless person, than an emotion that Hashem will heal me. Right? And it's like the emotion is more of the positive. Okay, but not, I'm Ashkenazi, so these are my mehagim. But what you see from the Rambam is, he says that these are mournful, not things you say on Shabbat. Shabbat is a time of joy, happiness, and you should only do those things which are joyful and happy. And then he ends with a great line, but of course, I don't know if this is the original Arabic, but he says, to quote from Eov, "V'ata tivchar v'lani, you choose, not me." Now, he's shown him convincingly that the guy's totally wrong, and then he says, and he ends very often like this, "You choose, not me," right? And the Katav Moshe, sincerely, Moses, as we began. So that's a survey of some of his letters, obviously hundreds of letters, we cannot squeeze them into 1 hour, but thank you for coming and schlepping in this weather, and amazing, I'm still shocked that you actually are here, but thank you very much.
By the way, in Kabbalah there's a shita that says that when a person becomes a ger, his neshama actually changes.
Yes, they have to say that because they hold up the neshama of a Jew.
No, but they say it's totally different. Right. And, but that explains really why it's cut and
shnola to me. Yes. Very, very.